Welcome to the Money Advantage Podcast, empowering business owners with the permission to think differently about money so that you can consciously choose to live a meaningful and fulfilled life now. Our passion is making money simple, fun, and doable, helping you feel great about your money and getting your money working for you so you can thrive.
Good morning and welcome back to the Money Advantage Podcast. This is Rachel Marshall and Bruce Wehner here today, and we have a special guest, and that is Joel Nagel. Now, I'm really excited for this conversation today, Joel, for a number of reasons. But first of all, thank you for being willing to join us today from Austria.
Well, thank you for having me.
Excellent. Well, let me just give a little bit of background and what we're talking about today. So we're talking about asset protection from a generational wealth perspective. And if you've been a listener for any length of time on the podcast, you know that we're talking about generational wealth and generational wealth planning and the desire to be able to not just create wealth, but to leave a lasting legacy that truly impacts your children and your grandchildren and beyond. And whenever we hear somebody who has that same passion and that same bent in their work, we are very quick to be able to have a conversation and a dialogue because there's something so beautiful about the work that you're doing, Joel, in that space. So I'm not going to give a long, lengthy introduction to you, but I do want to say that, Joel, you're an international business attorney with 30 years of experience, and you've been working in that area of international asset protection. And I clearly heard as I listened to a speech that you did from Nevis that was really about that crux of generational wealth planning and making sure that you are leaving a legacy for generations to come.
Yes, thanks for having me again. And it's a topic that I've been really focused on my whole legal career. Got very interested in that early on. And I started with a tax background, and we were really looking for ways to, you know, when I first started, there were still plenty of things you could do in the offshore space to get legal tax deferral. A number of those things have really gone away, but the one area that is still fairly wide open that I think a lot of people don't take advantage of is with regard to estate planning, generational wealth planning. You can build an asset's value in your name, but you don't have to do that. You can build it in another name. You can build it in a trust. You can build it in an insurance wrapper. There's lots of ways that you can build a wealth. And to the extent that you build wealth outside of your own name, outside of your own estate, then, you know, you can still avoid estate taxes. And you know, you can do that domestically and you can do that internationally. And our focus has really been in the international space. The phones ring all day, every day. One of my friends said, you have an amazing practice because you have an unlimited marketing budget that you don't have to pay for. Because as long as, you know, all the nonsense is going on in Washington, at least half the population is always mad, upset and scared and wanting to do something. And that's really where we come into play.
Well, Joel, it's fascinating that you're talking about the international space. And the real reason we wanted to bring you in is that you have this idea and this perspective of being able to work for the benefit of the next generation and the generations to come after that. And so a little bit of background here. I heard you on one of the family office events, one of the family office summits that Richard Wilson runs. And Richard Wilson is in that family office space, who's completely focused on helping wealthy families to be able to manage and grow and preserve wealth on a long-term basis. And he's bringing together a network of professionals that allow him to be able to do that and allow the families that he works with to be able to do that as well. Also, I found out that you are a business partner with Michael Cobb, who, if you've listened to the show, you recognize that name as well because he's been on the show multiple times before. And so there's just a unique connection or intersection here with the idea of preserving wealth, protecting wealth, as you're doing in that asset protection and estate planning space, and then truly wanting to be able to protect that in a way that might be outside of the typical way of doing things within the U.S. So can you share with us first, you mentioned coming into this space on the basis of tax. I think one of the questions that really arises from somebody who's interested in preserving their assets and protecting them is really, should I consider foreign trusts? I mean, maybe jumping right to that big picture conversation. And why would somebody consider using foreign trusts to be able to protect their assets here in the U.S.?
Yeah, great question. And I get that question all the time. There are a variety of reasons that people create structures offshore, trusts in particular, rather than domestically. When you create a trust anywhere, that is a what's called a juridical person, right? It's, you know, if you create a company, a company's owned by somebody, the shareholders of the company are the owners. But that's not the case with the trust. Nobody really owns a trust. It's a legal fiction that was created in the UK 1,000 years ago. And it's a person, and it's a separate person. So when I transfer an asset to that separate person, it's no longer mine. So if you sue me and I don't own it, you can't take it away from me. That's the basic premise with trusts, right? Now let's distinguish between domestic trusts and foreign trusts. When we create a domestic trust, we've created a domestic person. When we create a foreign trust, we've created a foreign person. And that person is subject to rules and laws and regulations and taxes in the jurisdiction of its citizenship. So if I create a trust in Delaware, it's a Delaware citizen. I file a Delaware state income tax, a U.S. federal tax return. If I create a trust in Nevis, it's a Nevis citizen. It's not subject to U.S. To Nevis tax, but because the U.S. person involved, the tax consequences do flow back to the U.S. And that's where, you know, at first, you know, looking at the issue, you might say, okay, well, it's not giving me a big tax benefit. Okay. And that's true. It's tax neutral because that foreign trust, the income from that foreign trust is going to flow back to your tax return the same as if you made the money, except there's a couple of distinctions. One, that foreign trust is separate and distinct. It's a different person. So when I die, that trust does not die. It's a different person, and it's a juridical person that won't die. It could go on for 1,000 years, right? Mm-hmm. So no estate tax. That is, you know, number one. That, of course, if it's done correctly, applies to domestic and foreign. Now you're going to have things like investing in foreign investments, for example, whatever it is. It could be conservative things like gold and real estate. It could be, you know, Bitcoin. It could be hedge funds. It doesn't matter. We focus on, we call it the defense, right? We're here to help people create these structures that are impervious to lawsuits and that help carry assets across generational barriers, right? From me to my children, to my grandchildren, like the same structure can do all of that. So now when it comes to why somebody's going to select a foreign trust, there's really just a few main reasons. There's probably lots of reasons, honestly, but a few that rise to the top. One, if you are predisposed towards lawsuits, for example, you're in a high-risk occupation, you deliver, you know, babies for a living, you're an obstetrician, gynecologist, you deliver babies, including premature babies, and of course, you know, if a baby comes out that's not perfect, somebody's going to get sued, right? That's the universe that we live in the United States. So if you're very prone to being sued, you want to put at least a portion, if not most, of your assets in a more protected strategy like a foreign trust, because again, that foreign trust, foreign person, cannot be sued, right? So the assets that are in that trust, whereas a domestic trust, you know, they're going to try to pierce the veil of the trust, you know, under Delaware law or Florida law or Texas law. And there's a lot of creative plaintiffs' lawyers out there, and they're, you know, very bleeding heart judges that think that the legal system is all about wealth redistribution. It's not about the real merits of the case. So, you know, it's more likely that a Delaware trust person will be subject to taxes than a Nevis trust person, right? Mm. So that's the litigation is number one. The investment is number two, because the U.S. securities laws have become so onerous that about 80% of the world's investments are closed to U.S. persons. Meaning, hey, I want to invest in this hedge fund in Malaysia. They say, nope, sorry, you're American. We're not going to take your money. Why? Because the U.S. SEC takes the position that if a foreign, you know, offerer sells an investment to U.S. investor, that they subject themselves to all U.S. securities laws. Now, there are big players out there in Switzerland and Brazil and you know, Japan, they're okay with that, particularly if they have a lot of U.S. investors. But what if you have a partnership with 20 guys and one American wants to be involved? You look at that and say, wow, I'm going to need a whole host of, you know, regulations. I'm going to have to apply for different exemptions in U.S. U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission is going to regulate me. Like, you're just going to say no. So many investments are closed to Americans. But when I create that juridical person in Nevis, to stay with that example, or Belize or Cook Islands or anywhere, right, just outside the U.S., now that Nevis entity can contract with that Malaysian entity and the U.S. isn't involved. So that's a major reason. And I think the third reason that I hear more and more is people really, really worried about the long-term prognosis of the dollar. Mm-hmm. The dollar, you know, has fallen precipitously. We don't necessarily see it on a day-to-day basis. But if you look historically, you know, compare it to gold, for example, the dollar's gone down 98% in the last 100 years, you know, from $20 an ounce to $2,000 an ounce, give or take, right? So the value of our money is declining. And when you create an offshore structure, you can frequently offset that better by making investments in different things, you know, Bitcoin, real estate, other currencies, Swiss franc, or different types of products like an insurance product that's designed to keep up with inflation and devaluation. So those are, sorry for ambling on, but I think those would be the three main things.
Bruce, I know that you're a little under the weather, so any time that you want to talk, you go right ahead.
Yeah, Joe, we have several clients that have asset protection trust. And, you know, before they were educated on their, you know, their, I would say there's some typical questions that come up all the time. One is this legal? And I know you've been studying this for years and years and sounds like a ridiculous question, but I'm curious if you get that. And then number two, they say, well, the only way this works is if I give up control of the asset. So would you clarify both of those topics?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first one's easy. And yes, I get it all the time. It's absolutely legal to create a trust anywhere you want in the world. There are no exchange controls on Americans, at least not yet. That's actually a reason why some Americans are rushing to create these types of structures now, because the feeling is in the future, the way the government's going, that they will stop and prohibit funds from flowing outside the U.S. to foreign structures. Mm. I've had somebody say to me, well, like, how do I know it's legal? I'm like, well, look, the IRS has special forms for foreign trusts and foreign companies owned by Americans. Like, do you think they would create the compliance regime for foreign entities if it was illegal to have in the first place? Like, that just wouldn't make any sense. So that's a pretty simple, straightforward thing. And, you know, I've talked to IRS agents. What they have universally told me over the years is, like, we're not in the business of, there's no judgment over where you structure your assets. The only thing they care about is whether you're reporting correctly and paying the tax on those investments. So if you have a trust in, you know, Nevis and you're paying your taxes, they don't care. If you have a trust in Delaware and you're not paying your taxes, they care. That's the only thing that is, you know, going to get you into hot water is if, you know, you don't comply. The idea that you know, this sort of cloak and dagger, hide and seek, I'm going to put my assets offshore, nobody's going to know about them, I'm not going to declare, I'm not going to pay taxes. Like, that's just in the movies. That doesn't really exist. Occasionally, somebody contacts me, and that's kind of their mentality or their attitude. And I always say, well, if you're going to break the law, you don't need to hire me to do it, right? I'm here to help you, engage you in a way that you're compliant with the law. And, you know, there's no reason that you can't structure all of your affairs offshore and be compliant with the law. Now, your second question, let's see, we were talking about legality, and then you're talking about control. Control is, you know, a huge issue. Clients, you know, particularly if they've made their money themselves, they managed it themselves, and now you say, hey, you're going to put this in a irrevocable trust, and there's an independent trustee. And, you know, that is a flashing red light that they're always worried about. But, you know, I would say most of them, when they look, if you're trying to day trade the market, then it's probably not the best structure, although there's some workarounds we could talk about in a minute. But most things, you know, when you're making medium and long-term type or generational investments for that matter, what you're really doing is sitting down with the trustee on a monthly, quarterly, semi-annual, annual basis, depending on, you know, how much you want to change your portfolio from 1 year to the next. And you're talking about these long-term trends, right? If I'm making an investment for my grandchildren, and I don't even have grandchildren, you know, what things am I going to be talking about? Maybe talk about gold, maybe real estate, Bitcoin, things that have a long, you know, trajectory. I'm not going to call them back 2 weeks later and say, oh, sell it. And then 3 weeks after that, buy it. You know, that's, if you're doing that, then these types of long-term structures might be a little difficult. Not impossible, by the way, but, you know, the friction costs of having a third party conduct, you know, that type of activity, it just goes to the expense side. But remember, most of these trustees that are banks and licensed trust companies in foreign countries, like, they're getting paid to do what you want, right? Now, they don't legally have to, because if they legally had to, then you would not have created a trust, right? Because you've transferred an asset to a trust. The trustee is the be-all, end-all. But who's the trustee? It's a bank. It's a trust company. And they're getting paid to carry out the wishes of the grantor on behalf of the beneficiaries. So, you know, I mean, I've been at this actually 35 years now and set up trusts all over the world, probably worked with hundreds of different trustees. And, you know, I can literally count on one hand the number of times that a client called and said, hey, I want to do this, and the trustee won't for whatever reason. And then you call the trustee, and usually there is a specific reason. It's not this general, like, oh, they wanted to buy, you know, IBM, but I thought they should buy Apple. Like, it just doesn't work like that. So most clients, when they sort of create a trust, they get their feet wet a little bit, they see that the trustee is handling the affairs the way they want them to be handled. And we can also, in addition to like the legal documents that I create as a lawyer, generally trustees welcome something called memorandum of wishes, which can be typed up by you. You can write them by hand. And you're basically just saying, well, if I had control, this is what I would do in this situation. And guess what? You know, 99.9 times out of 100, the trustee is going to do exactly that. So most people can get their arms around the control or lack of control. Now, for the cases where there's an underlying operating business, where there's active day trading, those types of things where the client feels like, hey, I have to have my finger on the trigger all the time. I wake up in the morning, that's what I'm going to be focusing on. I need to make decisions rapidly, and the trustee's going to slow me down. What we generally do is work with certain jurisdictions, certain trustees that are used to that kind of that kind of activity. And what they're going to do is create a company, normally offshore as well. And that company is going to run the day-to-day affairs of that business. And okay, the shares of that company are going to be transferred to the trust. So it's legally inside the trust. And then they're going to turn around and appoint the person who wanted to have the whole structure created as manager. They're not going to be the owner of the asset, but they're going to be the manager of the asset. They might be the signatory on a brokerage account. They might be, you know, the guy who can hire people and fire people at a company if there's an operating business. And the reason for that is that, you know, if a lawsuit ever comes, the trustee is the legal owner. And one of the things they can do is fire the manager, right? Which, if the manager gets sued, that would be the first thing the trustee would do. Say, hey, we gotta, it's like, you know, a turtle pulling its head and legs back into the shell. But, you know, there are plenty of trustees that will work with that kind of strategy. There's others that won't. You know, your big traditional UBS, they say, hey, like, we just want liquid assets, bring us your money, we'll invest in a portfolio that we all agree on. They don't really want to be in that level of minutia or day-to-day activity. But, you know, I think that if a client wants it, we can find it. We can find good trustees that, you know, are willing to work on that basis.
So one of the things, that comes up when I bring this topic up. You alluded to it earlier. You know, people say, well, I have a trust in the United States, because they're not looking at it for estate planning purposes. They're just looking at it for asset protection. And they'll say, I have a trust in the United States. I think that's plenty. And you already alluded to, yeah, but you have some type of judges that look at things differently. I would say that's, from my experience, that is true. However, there's still legal expenses to fight that particular situation. I have found in the people that we have dealt with, when it's an offshore situation, simply the documents stop any type of legal thing going forward. So very little money is spent on legal defense just because of the documents. Could you comment on that and how that would work?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. In fact, you know, it reminds me of a story that goes back to almost the very beginning of my legal practice. This is back in like very early 1990s. And, you know, a client came to me. He was a physician. He was in the process of selling his medical practice to the University of Pittsburgh, where I'm from, medical center. And he was getting $2 million. And we created an offshore trust for the individual. And, you know, he paid his taxes. There were no issues there. And shortly after the ink was hardly dry on the trust, when, you know, a former nurse brought a whistleblower case against him saying that he had defrauded Medicare. And, you know, it became both a civil and a criminal matter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're right. Like, all of a sudden we were hiring lawyers and, you know, blah, blah, blah. The criminal case went nowhere. The judge threw the matter out and said, you know, there had been no real evidence submitted showing that my client had done anything incorrectly. But when it came, the civil matter kept dragging along because, you know, the lawyers were pro bono lawyers. And I mean, not pro bono, they were contingency fee lawyers who were, you know, they were just going to try to get a settlement. And, you know, we went into a deposition. They're asking us a bunch of questions. We got around to the trust. They asked about the trust. We produced the trust document. I gave them the business card of the foreign trustee, said, you know, they'd be glad to, you know, answer any questions you have. And, you know, I could see on the other side of the table that the eyebrows were going up. They asked to take a little break and go out in the hall with their client. And, you know, they came back later and said, we're going to have to reschedule the rest of this deposition. The case was subsequently dismissed by the plaintiffs. And, you know, I talked to the lawyer. He didn't exactly breach his attorney-client privilege or relationship and tell me, but I kind of got the feeling that in that conversation out in the hallway, it was kind of like something like this. Well, Nurse Jones, like, you have a great case, but, you know, this these funds are offshore. It's going to cost a lot of money for us. We're going to have to engage counsel in the foreign jurisdiction. They're going to charge us hourly. You know, like, we can't do it on a contingency fee basis, you know. And then the nurse said, well, wait a minute, what about no fee unless you get money from me? So the mere fact that it was offshore, and it wasn't because we were hiding, it wasn't hide and seek, it was truly show and tell, like you say. And I see that a lot. I mean, there are a lot of jurisdictions, for example, where you simply can't bring a litigation against the trust in that jurisdiction unless you can allege an independent cause of action against that trust. It can't be against me, right? You say, Joel Nagel is the worst guy in the world. He's defrauded me. He's blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, here's a case people really know about, O.J. Simpson, right? The family of the people who, you know, got a judgment against him for, you know, wrongful death, you know, they've chased him and fought him and gone around the world, and they've identified places where he had created trusts, where there are assets sitting there. And at the end of the day, the trustee, the courts and those systems, they do not care about whatever the allegations are against him, right? They're saying, this is all about, not about OJ, it's about the OJ trust. Mm. What allegation, what cause of action do you have against the OJ trust? If you can't articulate and identify that and bring a suit against that, then, like, leave, go away. There's no standing. It doesn't matter how egregious the situation is. Mm-hmm. So that's really what we're trying to to do. We really go around the world trying to find the most protective, defensive systems. And then once you sort of build the platform there, put your money there, now you can use them to go invest in whatever you want. And we don't do that. Like, I'm strictly a defense guy, so I never tell a client what to invest in. I just say, hey, we're going to protect and preserve your money so it's there for you, your children, grandchildren. If you want a dynasty trust to go on for the next 1,000 years, you got it. And then what you and your trustee and your investment advisors discuss as to the best investments, I can certainly tell you from experience what I see wealthy families doing and the investments that they make in long-term generational structures are very different than what they maybe have in their current stock portfolio. We can certainly talk about that, but that's just me witnessing that. I'm not an investment advisor. I'm not telling you, oh, go do this or go do that.
That's a great transition into the question that we got on YouTube.
Let me ask the question. I want to build into it a little bit. So we do a lot of work with infinite banking or privatized banking, and this idea specifically that you can use specially designed whole life insurance to be in a position of not just storing cash value that you can use during your life, but also use that for family banking purposes and have an asset that you're providing capital to family members, children, grandchildren, to be able to use. And a lot of times when we're working with clients that really want this generational legacy transfer, there's a conjunction for them to be able to use trusts and creating specifically a memorandum of trust to guide the use of capital within their trust in conjunction with family banking and being able to have this idea of life insurance that would then purchase additional life insurance in future generations and use that as a tool to build this foundation of ongoing wealth and perpetual wealth for multiple generations. And so the idea of using life insurance and the idea of using a trust are something that we talk about often going hand in hand. And we get the question, and which is kind of the nature of the question I'm about to ask you from a listener, is the question becomes, well, how do I not just make sure that I'm guaranteeing this for my kids, but how do I make sure that this is something that I can specify that would go on for multiple generations in the future? And sometimes, I mean, we talk about 7 generations because of the Iroquois principle, that they had that planning, that they would make sure they're making decisions that were the best for 7 generations into the future. But then sometimes people say, well, what about, you know, thousands of generations, or what about that dynasty type of trust? And so that's the lead-in that I'm going to use for this question Fritz is asking. He said, good morning. Is life insurance more advantageous than a trust, or the other way around, or is it best to have both? And what is your take on this? So Joel, I'm curious to hear your thoughts and your perspective as it relates to that idea.
Yeah. And thank you for that. I mean, you know, it's actually a biblical concept that, you know, if you're going to build something, you should build it for at least 100 years, which, you know, there's 5 generations, you're talking about 7 and other people. I mean, we've done trusts for clients that wanted to create a trust that go on for 1,000 years. And look, if you're going to create something for yourself, your children, maybe your grandchildren, the focus is on consumption, right? This person can have this amount of money or this percentage of the wealth when they reach a certain age. But when you start thinking in terms of dynasty, it changes a lot, because now you're saying, how do I build an asset that can grow, can spur other investments, they can grow. And, you know, you want the total pot of wealth to be growing constantly, and you want the drawdown by the beneficiaries to be quantified. And usually when you quantify it, it's within the realm of just the income. And it's probably not even all the income, because you have to make allowances for taxes. You have to make allowances for devaluation, inflation, right? So if you do that properly, if a client comes to me and says, I want a trust to go on for the next 1,000 years, then by definition, the maximum drawdown that somebody can take would be about 50% or less of the income. So when you're structuring it for, let's say, your children, your grandchildren, it's not about what they can give you. It's about how the trust can help you. Right. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying we're going to give you a distribution of $200,000, it's, well, in this circumstance, to start a business or to buy a home or whatever, the trust is going to loan you, maybe on preferential terms, that money, and you're going to have the obligation to pay the money back. Why? Because the trust, if it's going to go on forever, it's not in the business of giving out money. It's in the business of growing the wealth.
Yes.
But maybe that person could not have gotten another person to loan or invest in their business. So, you know, I mean, the best example, of course, over the last 300 years is the DuPont family. You know, they created, you know, essentially a bank. That bank was really designed first and foremost for them. Now it's one of the largest banks in the country. And, you know, their family has been able to feed off that wealth many, many, many generations to where there's now hundreds and hundreds of heirs from the original trusts and beneficiaries. The Kennedy family is another one. You know, the father of John Kennedy and Ted Kennedy created a similar kind of dynasty trust that would go on and on. And there are mechanisms in there. Some of it has to do with like royalties to alcohol sold in the United States and, you know, things like that that you would laugh about. But it was really quite brilliant because those things over time have only become more and more and more valuable, right? Mm-hmm. The cost of alcohol goes up. That means the royalty goes up. That means there's more money to the trust, more money that can grow, and so on and so forth. So the way you sort of pursue a dynasty trust is very different than one that's just going to, you know, liquidate over one or two generations. The insurance part is it's a great hand in glove scenario because the trust is getting you asset protection, right? Everything we've been talking to up until now. Preventing lawsuits. But the trust doesn't do anything from a tax perspective, except estate tax, which we already mentioned. But from an income tax perspective, guess what? It doesn't. But guess what does address income tax, tax deferral, legal tax deferral? Insurance. Why? I don't know why, because the insurance industry spends hundreds of millions of dollars a year lobbying Congress. But, you know, there's no better loophole in the tax code than insurance. I am not an insurance salesman. I'm just telling you that, you know, insurance grows tax deferred and it comes out tax free as a death benefit, right? Mm-hmm. So how have clients of mine used trust and insurance together? Generally, what would happen is you would create a family trust rather than the patriarch or matriarch of the family who's 60, 70, 80 years old and is on has all kind of health problems, strokes and heart attacks and on 12 different medications, they're going to pick a child or a grandchild. We just did this not long ago. One of my clients, who's in his 80s, picked a 27-year-old granddaughter to be the measuring wife of the insurance policy. Why? The death benefit portion, the real cost of the insurance was low because a 27-year-old isn't probably going to die tomorrow and an 85-year-old will. Right. So you pick somebody at that level. And, you know, my client's comment was, well, I have plenty of enough money for myself, enough money for my kids, enough money for my grandkids. So he's insuring this young 27-year-old. That policy is going to grow tax deferred for the next 50, 60, 70 years. And then what's going to happen? All the money when she dies is going to pour back into the trust. And now the trust is going to have money for the successive generations. And if they're smart at that point in time, when that happens, is they'll identify another person further down the, you know, the family genealogy, and they'll insure that person, and you know, the whole thing will start over again. But, you know, even if the current generations blow all the money or consume too much or whatever, insurance is a great way to bring the money back and do it on a tax deferred and tax free basis. So yes, I love that strategy. It's a common strategy. You know, we could get into all the things you can do with insurance. There are some limitations, diversification rules and corridors and the ratio between the amount you put in versus the death benefit. There's a lot of technical rules, but at the end of the day, you know, if you can manage those rules and there are good insurance managers and trustees that are very familiar with this strategy that can manage that process in such a way that it achieves the goal for the client.
Yeah, we deal with those modified endowment contract rules all the time. So our audience is very familiar with that. So can you talk a little bit about, let's shift a little bit more towards maybe strategies you can do for asset protection outside of an offshore trust. So What can you share with the audience if a person just can't get their heads around taking their assets offshore and giving up what they perceive as control?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, we do a lot for clients in that space. In fact, like you said, the phones ring all day, every day. So we don't really like spend a lot of time focusing on other things. But, you know, I've written plenty of articles and spoken at different conferences, and these questions come up. So, in fact, I think we have a white paper. Be glad to send it out to your listeners. It's called 15 Global Strategies to Protect Your Wealth. And, you know, we've put them in different categories. I think the lowest category is like up to $250,000 in net worth, right? And then we go 250 to a million, and a million to 5 million, and, you know, above, I think 5 to 10, and then over 10. So it gives you different ideas based on how much wealth you have. You know, people say, well, how much money do I need to hire you? It doesn't really work like that. I mean, if you're in a high risk group, you're probably willing to spend money. Whereas if you're a school teacher and you have the same amount of money, you wouldn't hire us because your perceived risk isn't that great. But, you know, if you look, for example, at, you know, doing something like buying a precious metal. Now, I think a lot of people would argue, you know, like a Bitcoin or something like that. Bitcoin is obviously a lot more volatile, but you're creating stores of wealth that can last over generations, right? So 100 years ago, a 1 ounce gold coin could buy a finely tailored man's suit. And 100 years later, a 1 ounce gold coin can buy a finely tailored man's suit. So in terms of, you know, protecting assets over a long period of time, you know, gold is a good example of something that you don't need a structure, you don't need a lawyer, you don't need anybody. You have your little, you know, stash of gold coins. And, you know, when you die, they go to your children. And, you know, you've perpetuated that wealth. You've perpetuated the purchasing power of the wealth. Somebody's going to tell you that gold has gone up. I would say that gold is a store of wealth that remains constant. Mm-hmm. It's actually the paper money that's going down, you know, right, in relationship to it.
Yes.
So,
yes,
you know, so gold's kind of a no-brainer. I think real estate fits in that category pretty well. You were talking before about Mike Cobb. You know, he's the guru of international real estate. And, you know, like in our development company, sure, we're developing properties to sell and make money. But you know what? I sit there all the time and say, you know, if it's not a great deal for us, don't sell it. Like, you know, we have 5,000 acres of coastal real estate throughout Latin America. And you know what? I don't care if he sells it or not. Honestly, Mike will say, well, we got to sell so much and this and that. And yeah, we want to create returns for our investors. But if 10 years from now, that same 5,000 was not sold and was still sitting there, guess what? It will have more than outpaced inflation. It will be worth more. Mm-hmm. So gold, real estate, you know, there are other investments. You know, people say something like silver, same thing. It's poor man's gold. You can buy more of it if you have less money. So those are some of the strategies from an investment perspective. If you're talking about from a, like a legal perspective, that question, I would say,
yes,
okay, if you don't, you know, want an offshore trust, you could look at an onshore trust. You could create things like limited partnerships with your family members, whereby, you know, let's say you decide that you want to transfer assets to your children over time. You could create limited partnership interests that are set up in such a way that match the annual gift exclusion amount, and mm-hmm. or give away more units under your, you know, lifetime exclusion amount. And maybe you keep the 1% interest that's the limited or the general partnership interest, right? And then maybe if you have enough wealth, that 1% gets transferred to a trust for safekeeping. But even if somebody sues you when you have that, you know, the best thing they're going to get is something called a charging order. And, you know, you're going to make their life miserable. You're not going to declare a distribution, or maybe you declare one and don't pay it, which causes them to have a tax consequence. There's a lot of things like that you can do. A straight up corporation, you know, it's not perfect for everything, but your day-to-day, you know, issues where, you know, somebody, you own a piece of property and somebody slips and falls and gets hurt, that's a great shield to, you know, kind of protect you from the activities of the company. The converse, by the way, is not true. If somebody sues you for something unrelated, you can't protect the company from you. You can protect yourself from the company, but it's like a shield that you're holding out in front of you. If they get it, if the court issues a judgment against you, then they're going to come after your assets. And the shares of your company are just one more asset that you hold, including a foreign company. So I have clients sometimes saying, well, I didn't want to create a foreign trust. I just set up a foreign company and I'm comfortable with that. I said, okay, that's fine. And by the way, I think they've accomplished a great deal, but they haven't accomplished as much as they think they have, because I don't have to go to Nevis to sue your company. I can come to Maryland or Texas or wherever and sue you right there. And if I win, I'm going to have the judge order you to turn over the shares of your company to me. That's the risk, you know, you face by saying, okay, I don't want to go the whole way. For a lot of people, it makes sense because, you know, the cost is lower, the risk is lower. But for people that have a lot of wealth or in high risk groups, you know, you really do want the trust structure. But a couple of structure examples, a couple investment examples, and you know, I think you can if you're serious about asset protection, you don't have to be a millionaire. You can just focus in on some of these little things and get started.
So that actually,
that's really, Rachel, can I just follow up on that? So from my experience, you know, a lot of people say, well, how much do I actually need to worry about an offshore trust? Or does my net worth have to be? What I've found from conversations is the people in the lower net worth, but still high to the general public, you know, which would be like $5 or $10 million. They actually feel the need to have this a lot more than somebody that might have $30 million. Why? Because they realize that they've built up a pretty decent sum compared to most people. And the legal cost and the threat of actually losing that $5 million or $10 million would actually hurt them a lot more than somebody that might have $30, $100 million or above, because they can handle legal cost a lot more. And if somebody gets to 20% of their net worth, they still have a lot of money. Did you find that, or am I totally off base on that kind of situation?
I wouldn't say that wealthier people think they need it less, but I do understand the rationale you just threw out there. Where I see it the most are like 50 and 60 year old entrepreneurs that are, let's say, selling their company. They're selling their company. They're going to get a one-time payment, $5 million, $10 million, let's say in that range. And they are super paranoid, super scared that, you know, because they know they can only do this one time. And that money has to last them first and foremost, but then whether their kids, grandkids, however long they want to take it down the line, you know, it's not coming back. It's not recurring revenue. If you have $50 million, $100 million, you're probably making $3, $5, $10 million a year in recurring revenue. And you're right. If you have to pay off $1 million here or $1 million there, it's not going to put you out on the street. But for that person with $5 to $10 million, if they lose that at their age, there's no way to get it back. I mean, I had a guy come and see me, and he went through that. And he was very down. And I said, what's next? He goes, I guess I'm going to get a job as a greeter at the Walmart. I mean, imagine. I mean, a guy with, you know, one day $10 million and the next, you know, day he's got Social Security and he's, you know, greeter, part-time income at Walmart. I mean, those things can happen. And so I see that there's a real ferocity, let's use that word, or there's a real commitment. And, you know, they're probably not going to say, oh, I just want to put a portion of my wealth offshore. And you're like, no, this whole nest egg, I want it over here because it's going to be protected better.
That's fascinating. And you were talking about the idea of keeping something, specifically you mentioned limited partnerships and being able to then sell shares off to your children, or to be in a position where you're kind of spreading that ownership and control of a company. What would you say for somebody who maybe is building up generational assets, and maybe this is real estate, maybe it is properties, maybe it's multiple businesses, but they want to be in a position where they're using those assets to have their children take on ownership, and they want to pass the control and ownership to children and then ultimately to grandchildren? Not everyone's necessarily going to want to be involved in that business, or may not be interested in taking over the property management of real estate assets, or even the management at all of them. How do you how do you think through that question in terms of wanting your children to be able to have not equal ability to take out of a trust and take out of the income from business and real estate, but really to have that management and ownership where you're making sure that you're providing that opportunity for the management and control of assets in the future?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. And I see that a lot with my clients. You know, they do not want to turn their children or grandchildren into glorified trust fund babies, you know, laying around on a sailboat at 3 o'clock being drunk and high and, you know, just being a consumer of the wealth. They want them to cooperate. So, you know, a lot of times the structures are designed with that in mind. Maybe there's a passive part of the ownership, but there's frequently also an active part of the ownership where, you know, children that are involved in the business can end up with those management shares as opposed to just the passive shares so that they can sort of be calling the shots slowly over time. I think, you know, like in my own case, I have children that are in their 20s, and this is a great, great time. Two of them actually work in my firm, and, you know, they're taking on more and more and more responsibility. So that is the way I think you can use these structures to help them learn about stewardship, right? I mean, if they're going to take a role in a dynasty trust that's going to go on for 1,000 years, like it's way bigger than them, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to be pulled into the stewardship element for some period of time, you know, from when they're 20s or 30s to when they're, you know, 70s or 80s. I mean, and that's a long period of time. But when you compare that to the, you know, to the 1,000-year period that you're talking about, you know, it's really nothing. It's a snapshot. I think it helps them to view wealth differently. You know, that one of their jobs is to be a steward and help create it and not just consume it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think there's a lot of ways that you can sort of use more carrots than sticks to try to draw in the family members that are interested in what it is you're doing. And you know, it's not like you're going to cut off the people who aren't. But I had a client. He came up with a pretty ingenious solution for this. He had a dynasty trust, had a lot of money in there, and he had a lot of carrots to attract members into the family, into membership role, management roles and things like that. But there was a provision in his clause that he thought up. I didn't think it up. I've used it for other clients now, though, which it limits how much any beneficiary could take out of the trust in any year. And that limitation was it could not exceed what they earned on their own. Mm. So, you know, if one was an investment banker making $250,000, you know, they could pull out $250,000. If one was a teacher making $50,000, they could pull out $50,000. If they, you know, were unemployed, well, they really couldn't touch the trust, which you would think, well, that's when you would need the money. But, you know, again, he didn't want to create glorified trust fund babies. And guess what? The management positions in his organization paid pretty well. So when you could get paid pretty well for helping manage your family's assets, and then maybe if you needed a, you know, in any particular year more money, you could go to the same trust and get more. Like that, there were a lot of carrots there. And
I like that. And I've definitely heard the reciprocal amount before, you know, being able to access the amount that you're making in your life. But I didn't realize that incentivizing or paying for the management position was something that you could as well do. So there's so much value here. And I want to be able to wrap up a little bit early today, and mostly because this is just a powerful conversation. I know we could talk to you for a very long time, but you are focusing on this work just really with such a value to legacy wealth builders. I think you're ideally and primarily working with those legacy families. We have had a fantastic conversation today, and I would just like to direct anyone who has additional questions about this topic, where would you like somebody to reach out to you if they did have questions or if they were interested in pursuing working with you?
Sure. Well, our law firm, you know, it's info@nagellaw.com. Anybody can send anything there. If you have a very specific question, you can send it to me, joel@nagellaw.com. And with Nagel Law, there's the two L's in the middle. You have to make sure you get both of them. But, you know, the info is probably a good one to set up like a consultation or something like that. I do follow up as best I can with my emails, but you know, sometimes I'm a few weeks behind, but the info at Nagle Law is always pretty accurate. And you know, we sort of give away a lot of introductory consultations, and not everybody that calls us really needs us. Honestly, we advise them, well, no, you don't want to offshore trust, you know, you want this or that, and refer them to other people. But again, there's a lot of people more and more realize that this is exactly what they need. And we're always happy to help and then continue on with those who really do need and want the help and want to hire us to work on any of these things.
Well, Joel, this has really been a pleasure talking with you today. And I certainly encourage our listeners to reach out if that's something that you've heard really strike a chord in your planning for the future and really wanting to make sure that you are creating something that does last for a very long time, but then also has that protection component against litigation, really being able to handle offshore and international investing, and then really protecting against the devaluation of the dollar as well. So thank you for just bringing so many of those ideas really to a point today of making us realize that there are so many opportunities.
Thank you again for having me. It was a nice conversation. I know we sort of machine gun through a million topics. It was fun, and happy to chat more, you know, another time.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for being with us today. Thank you for tuning in to the Money Advantage podcast. Please go ahead and share your comments and questions. We'll try to get those back to you after the show as well. And like, subscribe, share this podcast with anyone who you feel would benefit from this concept of asset protection and generational wealth. And in closing, please remember, success leaves clues. So model the successful few, not the crowd, and build a life and business you love. We'll see you next time.
Discover the secret of how to earn a return on the same money in two places at the same time so that you can strengthen your investment returns. We've created a free guide for you that explains the top three things every investor needs their privatized banking system to do. Go to themoneyadvantage.com/banking, put in your name and primary email address, click the Send My Free Guide button right now, and we'll see you on the inside.